there, everybody, and welcome to Caffeination 352, 352nd edition here at the Caffeination Podcast. This is the privacy edition, so we're going to have some interesting stuff to talk about, a little DRM nonsense floating around, a little bit more about the Amazon Orwellian kerfuffle. It's all a lot of strange words, and we're going to be all trying to put them in the right order so you understand what exactly it is that we're talking about. It has been a great week so far. It's kind of shortened here at the Caffeination headquarters and down in the lair, but we're making the most out of it. Hopefully your week in work or wherever you happen to be listening to this show is going lovely as well. If you are looking for this podcast, it is lovingly nestled over at www.caffination.com. That is caffeination.com, being the Caffeination Podcast. It kind of fit to have that. So, all right, we have an interesting couple little stories. One major thing that I would like to just put out there right up front and personal. The Geekcraft section took over 90% of the episode today. We have a very tiny amount of food and caffeinated bits at the end, so not sure if that's what you're looking for, but it's just barely there at the end. There's just so many different stories out there that have a heavy focus on privacy and your rights online that I kind of wanted to focus on that. So it's going to be a little bit more of a serious show up until, of course, we get to the standard Caffeination news stories that I usually put out there, some of the funnier and weird ones that I have a tendency of finding online. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to say the least. The Summer of Podcast Contest is continuing over at podcastmadness.com. This week's shows are the SDR News Podcast with Andy McCaskey, Ham Radio Podcast, Totally Cool Tech with Norbert Davis, and the Forcefield Podcast with Rick. So it's a great little mix-up of shows. You can head on over there and find out what all the different code words, then head back to podcastmadness.com, enter your first name, last name, email, and the code word, and you too can win any one of the number of prizes that are out there. Now, I'm not really sure if I'm supposed to be giving out the code word for my show on today's podcast or not, so if you want the code word for my podcast, the Caffeination Podcast, you can head back to the last two episodes, 350 or 351, and the codes within the first 5 or 6 minutes of the show. So that'll hopefully simplify your life if you're looking for it. I don't want to anger the madness gods here. So, all right, there's a great little great couple of stories that have kind of worked their way up to the top. It's talking about Google Wave, bad poetry, Amazon's in the news still from last episode. So we're going to try and get to all of that. But before that, we did want to make mention of our sponsor for today's show. Today's show is sponsored in part by GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting produces a fantastic product that allows you to complete projects faster by showing people what's on your screen in real time. You can cut your travel costs during these tough economic times through flight costs, hotel costs, gas costs, anything that goes and pulls money out of your pocket as you're trying to get business done in a timely fashion. You can meet with anyone, anywhere, anytime, right from your desk. You can collaborate on real-time presentations, documents, spreadsheets, demonstrate product, or even conduct a sales presentation, all from the same piece of software. It's incredibly easy to set up. It's literally a 2-minute setup. Has an integrated phone and voice over IP conferencing tool included. You can meet as many times as you want for the entirety of just $49 a month. Lets you hold unlimited meetings, no overages, no hidden charges, no nothing. Just to start your free 30-day trial, please visit www.gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts. That's www.gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts for a free 30-day trial. I'd like to thank GoToMeeting for being a continued sponsor here at the Caffeination Podcast. They're allowing us to do all kinds of crazy and cool stuff like you see here on today's episode. So, there's so much news that I'm almost worried about kind of beating a dead horse here, but privacy is a chief concern anymore. It is kind of insane that a lot of these stories are sticking around. It's kind of insane things are being allowed to happen. So I'm going to give you my opinion on it. I'm going to hopefully not color the news stories that are out there with too much opinion one way or another unless I tell you it is. So if I tell you this is what the news story says, that's what it says. If I tell you it's what I think, that's what I think. It's pretty much that simple. All right, so the first little story we have up for you here is rather simple. It's kind of a benign. It's called Google Wave. Now, it's been out, the demo's been out for about a month, but it just was released today that there's going to be a rollout of new invitations being sent out on September 30th, so you can head on over and sign up. what I decided to do, because I've been watching the video for the past couple of days at night, because I apparently have nothing better to do, and what I was doing was actually taking notes. I don't know why I found myself taking notes during it, but I started taking notes in an outline form. So rather than you having to watch the 120-minute long demo of Google Wave, which, as much as I love Google, they really kind of need to take a page out of Apple's book and learn how to concisely demo products in a real quick manner. You lose people's attention, because you're not just demoing it to the developers that are in, also demoing it to the people at large. And it's a great product. It's a lot of really cool stuff, and it's a really, really early view into what the product's going to be capable of doing. The first and easiest thing to say is that a wave is a noun for a conversation that takes place. They postulated that email was actually created before the internet was around. There was a network, because that's how you send things from one thing to another. It was created before SMS. People have evolved beyond these things allow for. I mean, they say email was predicated on the previous experience with snail mail. So it was predicated on somebody writes a letter, somebody receives a letter. There was a certain point in time when you had to wait for a response, and everything, including instant messenger, always is predicated on the fact that you need to wait for the response. It's a challenge and response. So that way your conversation lives on. It's just the distance between the times when the letters were actually received was shortened. That it goes gets thrown out the window with Google Wave. It's interactive. It's a fluid conversation. You can actually see somebody's typing in an instant message format. You can see somebody's typing and interrupt them by interjecting your own comment. I pretty much guarantee it's not going to happen right away. You're going to pretty much wait for the person to get done. But you can really jump the question, as in Jeopardy. You can kind of try and answer it before it actually happens. You can do this with emails. You can do this with messages going back and forth. You can do this with wiki documents. So you can, you know, interactively live edit documents. You can live edit photo bunches. They have all of these really great and interesting robots that actually kind of live within the Google Wave platform. Everything exists within your browser. Nothing is installed in your computer at this point in time. So it's really kind of cool to see exactly what they show you. And what I did was I did a play-by-play of the video. I gave you a huge, long, drawn-out outline of what went down in the video. I tried to keep it as chronological as possible. I did end up kind of pushing all of the robots into one thing, so they have Spelly, Linky, Bloggy, Searchy, Polly, Twitty, Buggy, and Rosie as the robots that they put out there. Yes, I know they all sound like Pac-Man ghosts. However, they each do different things, and they're all basically extensions that live within the hierarchy of Wave. They allow you to do different things. For instance, Spelly is a contextual spell checker, which is unbelievable. It actually can tell the difference between bean soup and bin soup. So if you're typing and you type in B-E-E-N space soup, it will change it to bean. I mean, it's amazing. They showed you a couple different demonstrations. This is the kind of thing that I need. I am horrible with spelling, both in job applications and everything else. I have to look over it like 15 times before I actually submit something, because I don't want to come off as uneducated. I mean, that's perfectly fine if you're talking to me and I start butchering pronunciation, which is another problem. I think it's probably related to the fact that I can't spell anything, that I can't pronounce anything either. Yes, I know that was incorrect, but still. There's a lot of really interesting little tidbits that happen. So if you have 80 minutes that you'd like to kill and kill dead, you can watch the proceedings that they have over there at wave.google.com, or you could just read my rundown and kind of see what they're talking about. It's going to be interesting. So I wanted to kind of push that out there. And the other thing is, if you go to sign up, they have a rather interesting they have a rather interesting form so that you can actually sign up for an account. They go through and they say, let me see. All right, here it is. Your email address, whether or not you're going to provide input, what do you want to use the Wave with, and write a message to Google Wave team, haikus, sonnets, ASCII art, all accepted. So I took this as a challenge and decided to inflict myself upon you Vogon style. So I gave them one haiku, which is communication connects us to each other, humanity's gift. A little 575 rhyme there. And then I actually attempted to do a sonnet, which I could not fit into iambic pentameter, rather. So here, without further ado, is my attempt at a sonnet to hopefully placate the Google Wave team into giving me an account. In this diverse world we find ourselves in, communication is our only link, a tense connectivity on the brink, a real interaction beyond our kin. Like-minded people flock to a feather, a simple solution begs to be found. Where do we find this hidden common ground? A nebulous place as fickle as weather. Social networking, a faddish term, it's true, yet it speaks to a longing for meaning, a subtle whisper, a gentle leaning. Towards community, with very small clues. Online world, changing from city to cave. I would like an invite to Google Wave. So that, I'm hoping, actually gets me into the thing, and I apologize profusely for inflicting my poetry upon you, but hopefully you enjoyed it. At one point in time, I used to love to write poetry. Really haven't been doing it too much recently. But if you'd like to read the horrible prose, you can head on over to travelersmug.com and actually check it out. It is really and horribly bad, I tell you this right now. Okay, now we're going to be moving on to the next little story here, and stuff that I didn't write. Amazon kerfuffle is in a stark light, as the fine folks over at Slate have begun to actually kind of drill down. They said that 1984 is actually alive and well, and this is not the first time that Amazon has actually kind of pushed this button. But here, in a nutshell, is what happened. Amazon actually redacted people's purchases of 1984 and Amazon and Animal Farm, rather, because they said that the publisher who put them out there did not have the rights to distribute the books. They did this without notice and without any say-so from the people who owned the books. Basically, one day the books were on their Kindle, the next day the books had been wirelessly removed and refunds had been given to their account, which, you know, it's good that they got the refund. That's fantastic, but that's not what they're complaining about. People are complaining about the fact that if you walk into a bookstore and you bought 1984 and Animal Farm, then you would be able to take them home, and nobody, no matter what happened, could come into your house and say, yeah, I'm sorry, we didn't have the rights to distribute this book, so we're taking it back. They could take it back from the publishers. Any unsold copies would remain unsold. But that's not how it's going to work in the future, and they're saying that we are entering into a really bad time for actually owning any technology. Will your kids ever be able to understand the idea of actually owning a book or owning a song? So it's like nobody can come into your house and say, yeah, I'm sorry, you don't have the rights to lend that CD to your sister, but right now you can't lend that digital download to your sister unless she's using your account on iTunes. And there's something very wrong with how people are being pushed to believe in content and whether or not it's theirs. So there's a rather interesting article over at Slate that is why this article, this idea and this problem will never actually die. And Amazon, despite the fact that they've promised that they're never going to delete the books again, they're going to be pushed forward to doing it. So it's like you're not only allowing yourselves to be remove things that don't have the rights, but you're also allowing yourself to go down that slippery slope where at one point in time a government might ban a certain book. Amazon now has the technology to go in and say, okay, you know what? You didn't want to read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And guess what? The government no longer says you can. So guess what? You no longer have access to that title. That's a problem. So, I mean, banned books are one of the treasures that generations after you can look at and say, I wonder why that was banned. But they still exist. I mean, if this is the case and this is how books are pushed forward in the future, all digital downloads, I'm not saying that it's going to happen because, trust me, I'm not giving up my library anytime soon. But if this is how books are going to be pushed forward, then it is a very real possibility that you could start to see fewer and fewer continued works if they're ever banned again. It's going to be a scary future, so it's going to be interesting to see exactly how it all plays out. All right, now the next little thing we have for you here is Verizon on privacy, not piracy. Verizon has currently raised the ire of a lot of privacy advocates, basically saying that even if you have an unlisted number, the chances are that all of your personal data, your cell phone number, who you call, where you live, and the number of your private therapist, whatever it is all up for sale on the internet somewhere. So if you want to, and there's an article over at the Washington Post that allows you to go through it, so you can actually go online and buy access to these records searching for people's names. Well, one gentleman decided to do just that, and he actually pulled a prank on Verizon's CEO and bought his personal information, Ivan Seidenberg's personal information, found out where the man lived, and drove to his house with a bullhorn and interesting things commenced. Basically, he was chased down by a neighbor's dog. But you can actually watch the video. It's incredibly scary to realize that this could actually happen to you. And if you know somebody's name, that's all you need. Depending on how unique their name is, you know, that's, you know, pretty much a slam dunk. So basically, he actually searched for, He's calling for Verizon and the other cell phone carriers out there to push for stronger privacy. They're saying that, you know, you can't resell our information. So the only good thing is that it's kind of a leveling factor, so that there's nobody who is completely above the law. There's there's nobody who's completely above this. I mean, obviously you got to the CEO, but so it's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens beyond this. I'm pretty sure that the prank's pretty much going to go unnoticed, because you're never going to see this thing on network TV. I mean, that's what it would take. You need like a Dateline exclusive or something, and that's really horrible to think of. All right, moving right along. Yet more privacy kerfuffles abounding. Tiburon, California. They're going to take your picture. Whether you're coming or going, this affluent little coastal town is going to be taking a picture of every single car entering and leaving their city. But don't worry about your privacy. They're basically saying that if you're not doing anything wrong, if you're not driving a stolen vehicle or going on a crime spree while you're here, your anonymity will be preserved. We don't care who you are, and we don't know who you are. Well, here's the problem. They're going to be having a database of all the license plates that go in and out of their city. And it's not the problem of the fact that they're saying it's an innocuous use of this database. The problem is, who watches the watchers? And I struggle sometimes to voice this argument to people, and even, you know, people who I consider close friends, I've had this argument before. They said, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what's the real problem? Well, I'm pointing you now to Bruce Schneier, who actually has a fantastic essay that I really kind of need to memorize parts out of. It's not the fact that he thinks for me. It's the fact that he explains what I've been trying to say for years. It's not necessarily to say that, you know, you're not doing something wrong, so you shouldn't be watched. It's to say that who watches the watchers, and the absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the idea and the problem with these invasions into your privacy is that there are no checks and balances on top of it. And he goes on to say in other phrases, he says, the Cardinal Richelieu once understood the value of surveillance, and he famously said that if one would give me six lines written by the hand of the most honest man, I would find something in them to have him hanged. Watch long enough and you'll find something to arrest somebody, or just to blackmail somebody. Privacy is important because without it, surveillance information will be abused to peep, to sell to marketers, and to spy on political enemies, whoever they happen to be at that time. He makes an incredibly strong case throughout the rest of this article. It was written in 2006, and it is no less true today than it was then. So I highly suggest that you head on over to Schneier.com, and I apologize profusely if I'm mispronouncing his name. It's just what I happen to do, unfortunately. Now the next little thing we have up for you. If you're here to limited edition data, remember back to Mission Impossible, and this message will self-destruct in 5 seconds, and then it blows up, and then it's gone. Well, here's the problem. Digital is everlasting. Once you digitify something, once you have a video, and it's on YouTube or something like that, that video never dies. It's quite possible that that thing will live on in perpetuity. If you put something into the cloud and you say delete it, I mean, even if you delete your web history, Google says they can keep it for a couple days or weeks or whatever. So no matter what you think somebody's motives are in looking into the things that are attached to your account and your activity online, they will always persevere beyond what you think they will. So with this in mind, there's a new company that's come out that's called Vanish, self-destructing digital data. Now I'm highly curious as to how this is actually going to work, but basically they're saying that that all of the data that you share with another person is going to have a time limit on how long it will be available. And the data is accessed through a held privacy key that is on Vanish's servers. So that basically, you have your copy, it's decrypted by talking to Vanish. They have their copy, it's decrypted by talking to Vanish. Once the time limit expires, Vanish destroys the privacy key, and both of them are left as encrypted messes. You cannot access this. So they have it as a Firefox plugin, they have it as a Windows thing. I'm really kind of interested in this, and I'm actually pretty sure that I might want to try it. The only problem is, if you're saying something's unencryptable, I would highly, I consider that highly suspect. I mean, security through obscurity is no security at all, and I keep forgetting where that came from, except for the fact that it came from my friend Dan, who said it religiously all the time. But just because you say that you destroy the key doesn't necessarily mean that nobody else can ever find it again. It just means that it's incredibly hard to do so. So thinking that just because you're sharing something with someone that says that the privacy key is going to be deleted does not give you carte blanche to discuss whatever you want, because they're going to have the same issues that PGP had when, you know, they find out all of a sudden, oh my god, terrorists are sharing information, or people we think are terrorists, or, you know what, people who are just from the other political party are sharing information back and forth. Then the government's going to step in and say, yeah, you know what, that's all fascinating and everything, that's fantastic that you're providing that key and then you're deleting it, but we're going to want access to that. And who knows what's buried deep in the Patriot Act that's going to allow them to actually do that. So I wouldn't share anything that's too highly confidential with that, but it's an interesting idea that they've put forth so far. And this brings me to a reminder of William Gibson's famous Agrippa, the Book of the Dead. When he originally put out the poem, it was on a self-destructing disc. The text of the poem was preserved, but one run-through of the poem would actually destroy the copy that was on the disc. So it was unencryptable. You could not get it after the fact. But that does not stop somebody from recording it while it's happening. And there was one copy of the program that actually ran while somebody was videotaping it. So they have a complete, you know, run-through of the program so that you can actually see it and hear it and experience it, similar to how it was done. So it's really kind of crazy to actually see it, and I highly suggest that you head over to UC Santa Barbara's website and actually do it. It's one of my favorite works by William Gibson. It's a really kind of interesting look into how cameras and everything kind of work on the immediacy of moments. But still, it's an interesting poem, and they've preserved it in a state when it was never meant to be preserved. It was a collaboration between Dennis Ashbaugh and William Gibson, so that it was supposed to run once. I mean, even the collection of information that was actually given with different versions of the book, you know, as soon as they were exposed to light, you know, they started to degrade and they started to reveal different images behind them. So there is no one perfect copy of this information available, but this was never supposed to be beyond that. So once all of the versions of the disc were played, there was never supposed to be a perpetual version. Now there is, and that was an unintended consequence because the files were digital. So, you know, it's just kind of speaks to the idea of privacy in general. If you want something to be private, don't put it online. I'm just putting it out there for you. And I mean, hey, even Gibson did it in 1992 before there really was an online, and it still got up there. So, and I mean, and the funny thing is, not even our ancestors are safe here. Medieval battle records from the time of Henry V have now been put online, as told by the BBC News. It's a great article that details information about the 250,000 medieval soldiers, including archers who served with King Henry V at the Battle of Agincourt. So it talks all about the Hundred Years' War, it reveals salaries, sickness records, and who was knighted. So it's really cool. So you can see things from 1369 to 1453, an incredibly long database. It's really kind of cool. But here's the thing. BBC did a great job of putting all this information up there, but they neglected to put a link to the website. And this is yet another example of the fun people in traditional media who kind of, you know, push it aside, the websites. They're glad to kind of put information about the websites up there, but what they needed to do was actually send a link to the website so that you could actually go online and check it out. So if you have history dating back that far, or if you just want to check it out for surnames or anything else that might seem interesting, you can go to the link that we have put up there. It's a Soldier in the Latter Medieval England, the exciting AHRC research project. So they're saying that the site may be a little slow, so you can save the link for a little bit later, but it's really cool to actually check out. You can all see the database, the soldier profiles, and what they're going to be giving out information and when. So it's really kind of fun. All right, next little thing we have up for you here is OnStar can now shut off your engine remotely, disable the ability to start, just in case the car is stolen. This is a story from over at Engadget.com, which is really kind of interesting. You're like, wow, that's a great feature. Okay, now imagine a bug in the system or a malicious person getting in there, or imagine a short in the system that just shuts it off your car so that it no longer is able to start. There's a big problem here. I don't like any car having the ability to just shut itself down remotely, no matter how no matter how benign the initial reason is. I mean, I would much rather just have it have the ability to track the car. Okay, fine. So you can track me wherever I am. I understand that. And, you know, despite the fact that we've talked about that recently, if you want OnStar in your car and you want to have that service available, that's one of the things that you give up for that service. But I don't want to give up the ability to have my car start. In fact, we recently had an issue with our own car, which does not have OnStar in it. But I went to start the vehicle after a fantastic block party the next day where I parked a couple blocks away, and the battery was dead for some unknown reason. Now, this is a relatively new car. It's 2007, so turned the key. The car did not start. One of the lights blinked. Nothing else went on, and it shut off completely. And here's the fun thing. I did not know this, but newer cars that have all these battery and computer-assisted everythings, after you try and turn the thing on, if the battery's dead, it won't let your key out of the car. So I had to leave the key in the car, which is a fantastic idea, let me tell you. Cover it with a blanket or something else so it didn't look like there was a key in the car, lock it back up, walk home, get my wife with the other key and a cell phone because I didn't have it with me, walk all the way back and call roadside assistance to get them to come and give me a jump. It's just one of those things where it's like, you know what, maybe the best idea here is to allow the key to actually come out of the car so that you can be free to roam around. And it was just really weird and kind of defeated the entire purpose of having having the ability to walk away from a car with a dead battery. I had to actually take the key off my ring to make it useful again. So I just thought it was kind of crazy. The only thing is that they're saying with this system is that the police are going to have to confirm that the car is actually stolen before OnStar will actually flip the switch. So you can't call up and actually have a prank run on somebody, which is good, but it does not yet. I don't trust any system to be fail-proof. I don't trust any system to be devoid of glitches. So you have that there. Now, if you live over in Germany, they might be attempting to use your car for something else. That is, Germans are going to be using your car horn to warn about natural disasters. This is an interesting little idea, and it takes the idea of air raid sirens one step further. Basically, there's a burning factory, there's some other issue, there's a satellite falling, I don't even know. I'm trying to decipher the thing as I'm going through. But they're saying that much like the Amber Alert, much like any other issue that's being pushed out through radio or stuff like that, they would program something into car stereos or into everything to receive these signals from satellites to actually allow for the horns to start going off as a way to have it like a national air raid siren, you know, if there was a massive fire or something in the area. It's interesting, and it's a lot less there's a lot less issues with this than any of the other things we've talked about today, but it's one of those things where you're looking at it and you go, you know, how can that actually get messed up? I mean, what happens if, you know, there's an electric storm, your car gets a little shocked by some lightning? I mean, you go out to the car and all of a sudden the horn won't shut off because it somehow fried the chip that told it to shut off or something like that. I like the idea in theory again, but it needs a little bit more tweaking to actually make it work. I'm not really sure how any of these things are going to make it to actually be produced, but who knows? All right, moving right along, because we are burning daylight here at the Caffeination. I'm not used to having this much geek cruft, but like I said, there's so much stuff to talk about. We just can't swallow it all in one breath here. Apparently, there are some people who specialize in robot ethics. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the word that it kind of associates with all that, but they want to revamp Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. Now here's a small problem with this, that a robot, here's the three laws as they are read basically. A robot may not injure a human being or allow one to come to harm through action or inaction. A robot must obey orders given by human beings, and the robot must protect its own existence. Each law takes precedence over the ones following it so that you can't order a robot to kill people. Well, here's the issue. Robot ethics people want to kind of work these and say, you know, these laws are flawed, there's major problems with these. In reading the comments on this article, this is over at Wired.com, there's a couple things that these ethics professors missed. First of all, nobody has built these laws into any robots yet. So, despite the fact that they're pure fiction, you're spending time talking about them. And they're saying, you know, there was a war machine that was accidentally killed six people. Or there was another machine in a factory over somewhere which grabbed a guy's head and almost killed him. If these robots had the laws in there, they might not have done it. And the other thing that a lot of the different comments on the website actually said is most, if not all of the stories that Asimov written that actually talked about the three laws, talked about how inherently flawed that they actually were. There were small problems and things fell through the cracks. And it says that, you know, even with something as simple and seemingly as pure and unencroachable as these were, there were issues with each one of these laws and how they were implemented in the robots. You know, there could be something like a glitch or some other problem that stopped them from functioning correctly. So it's going to be kind of interesting. And I for one, really think that, you know, ethics kind of needs to be taken into account. And if you're going to be building robots that go out there like in South Korea and defend the border, there's no way to tell that robot that, okay, all the people who are wearing our color uniform are cool and all the people who are wearing the other color uniform are bad. We can treat them as animals. You can shoot them up like target practice. That's just not going to jive. Robot sensors, you know, no matter how detailed they are, there's always going to be some issue with that. I mean, you know, for instance, the enemy could, hey, change the color of their uniforms, or you know, you need that human interaction to decide whether or not somebody's going to live or die, because there's just so many issues associated with these. And who do you blame when a robot goes off the reservation and starts, you know, whacking people left and right? Are you going to assign blame to the programmer? Are you going to assign blame to the operator, if there even is one? I mean, who's to actually blame? Can you blame the robot itself? Does it matter if you put the robot in prison? I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to have to be tackled in the very near future. I don't think attacking the three laws of robotics, a purely pure work of fiction, is going to be is even worthwhile. I mean, even if these robots had the three laws in there, you wouldn't be able to build a robot to guard your borders because it would never kill people coming across the borders. So you have that problem. All right, moving right along because, I mean, hey... There's only so much time that we can actually talk about all this stuff. We have a couple more little stories, then we're going to hedge on into the incredibly truncated, voodoo and caffeinated bit section. Sauron's Eye to be installed in Hawaii. Well, not incredibly accurate, but they're saying that the world's most powerful telescope is actually going to be installed in Hawaii. It's going to be 9 times bigger than any other telescope on the planet. That's going to be really kind of cool. I wonder why they're choosing Hawaii. I mean, it doesn't really seem to be the most stable of land masses to actually build something like that, but 9 times larger than any other terrestrial telescope. So it's really impressive and actually kind of looks a little bit like an eyeball. I don't know Sauron's eye. It doesn't have the giant flaming sphere with the strange reptilian iris from the movies, but I mean, hey, it could be that. I mean, if you're worried about privacy concerns, we're going to be international peeping Tom, or interplanetary peeping Toms, rather. All right, now it's always interesting when you see a company that has a bad overall image actually come back down to really help other people out. And Walmart has a strange image in popular culture. There's some people who love it because they have cheap prices. There's other people who hate it because they're either union and they, you know, have been told to hate it, or they hate it because, hey, it's running all the smaller stores out of business. Then you have the pure capitalists who say, hey, Walmart's just doing what Walmart gotta do to stay as big as Walmart is, or even get bigger. I mean, that's the natural progression of things, is that how they go in capitalism. So, I mean, there's a myriad of different impressions, and most people probably fall into the, hey, you know what, I need socks and I'm next to Walmart, I think I'm going to go get socks in Walmart. I'm pretty sure that's where most, if not all, of the people in the world kind of fall into. So it's interesting to see Walmart throwing money at a problem that a lot of people have put out, you know, that this is a huge problem that nobody can tackle. Walmart has money to burn like there's no tomorrow, but they're saying that they're actually going to start working on an environmental footprint database for everything they sell. Now they don't mention the words open source, but they're saying that they want other people to use this as well. They're saying that there's a lot of different people who've put forward the idea of being ecologically minded. Well, how much is that ecology worth to you? They're making a universal footprint rating for meaning enviros to actually try and measure which one is better for them, which one's better for the environment. So they're saying it's going to take an incredibly long time, 5 years, to actually get up and running. Now, they never use the word open source in it, but they say that they want other retailers to use this as well. So it's quite possible that they're going to throw the initial cash at this thing, try and get it up and running, try and hire the horde of people that it's going to take to work on all the products that Walmart already sells, and then have other people have the ability to add information into this database. Now, if it stays an open and free database, this is going to be a huge resource to people from around the world. So it's going to be kind of cool to see exactly how much, you know, the Fig Newtons actually are hurting the environment versus if you bought Chips Ahoy or Chewy Chips Ahoy versus regular Chips Ahoy, and how much you're willing to destroy the environment because it's Chewy rather than regular. I personally would be willing to destroy several small rainforests for Chewy as opposed to probably only a medium-sized one for regular Chips Ahoy. I'd much rather prefer the Chewy. I'm pretty sure somewhere in there is the oils just make it bad for the environment in general. So, that being pushed aside, how would you like to talk about the end of the world? Yes, the Large Hadron Collider is back in the news. It's going to be kind of fun. Well, apparently, not yet. Every single time this thing goes to fire up, there's some massive problem. It's been worked on since the mid to early 90s. I keep forgetting the actual date when it was started, but this thing is hundreds of meters underneath the Swiss Alps. It is the largest particle accelerator on the planet. It is the largest machine on the planet. It is stationary. It just has a ton of parts with it, and everything has to operate perfectly in order for it to do what it's supposed to do. That is, try and take apart the very atoms of our existence. Attempt to create antimatter, as the case may be. So who knows exactly what they're going to attempt to do for the first time, but particle collisions, they're trying to break down the particles to the tiniest possible building blocks. They're trying to find, I can't remember the different particle names, but they've broken down the electron, they've broken down the proton, they've broken down the proton, the neutron, all these other things to try and find the quarks, the subquarks, and all these other things that exist tinier than you can ever even possibly comprehend. And they're trying to get down to the absolute building blocks. What are they calling the God particles inside of every atom on the planet? They're going to attempt to restart recently. There's a whole bunch of issues, so they had to delay it again because of vacuum leaks. Now, I don't know about you, but something that's supposed to create a perfect vacuum, if it's leaking, you know, you probably want to just hold off a little bit. So they're going to be pushing it back to, again, mid-November. So it's now going to be happening to coincide with the Leonidas meteor shower. They're saying it's a coincidence. It's over at Engadget, so it's a lot of snark, obviously. But I'm saying it's probably going to fire off in 2012. Anybody have any worries about that? All right. Now, the next little thing we have for you here is university scientists enter a new phase of automotive laser ignition research with Ford. So Ford is apparently attempting to kick your spark plugs out the door. And instead of having a regular old spark, you're going to have lasers in your engine, which is going to be all kinds of cool. Now, if you could refocus the lasers to blow the guy in front of you who's slowing down traffic out the water, that would be even cooler. They're saying that the use of lasers is actually going to increase the efficiency of the combustion inside the engine and hopefully give the internal combustion engine a larger and longer life cycle. So who knows where that's going to end up. It's going to be kind of interesting to see exactly what it does. All right, next little thing that we have for you here, second to last little bit inside the Geekcraft section is to the moon, Google. Yep, that's right, I went there. The moon is now one of the featured objects within Google Earth, as well as a huge kind of cool different little maps series that they have up there, so you can see high definition maps of all over the moon. You can see the different landing sites. You can be actually taken on a tour with Buzz Aldrin and some of the other astronauts that are up there. It's a great trailer. I highly suggest you actually play through it. It's only 2 minutes and 51 seconds long, so it's well worth your time, and you're going to be amazed at the astounding discovery of the moon all over again. So, or the conquering via exploration. So we are celebrating the 40-year anniversary of landing on the moon, the Apollo 11 iconic landing on the moon. So Google has decided to open up the moon for observation in Google Earth. So I thought it was pretty cool and wanted to share it with the group, with direct to the Google blog. Then the last little thing, which just got added in right before I started talking into the microphone here today, and wow, we are running on here, is things your kids may never know. 100 things that are existing now or may have existed sometimes in your past that your kids might never see. For instance, inserting a VHS tape into a VCR to watch a movie or record something. Blowing inside a Nintendo cartridge to get it to working. Use jumpers to set RQs on your computer. Turning a PlayStation on its end to try and get a game to load. Joysticks. Recording a song in a studio. Privacy. Words that don't generally have numbers inside of them. The correct spelling of phrases rather than TLAs. Answering machines. Rotary telephones. Typewriters. I mean, there's just so many different things that are up there. One of my favorite is actually Lego just being square blocks of various sizes with odd wheel, window, or door thrown in. There's no funky little parts in there. And there's a whole bunch of other things. And the last one they have up there, when a geek and a nerd were one and the same. So I wanted to share that with the group, and hopefully you enjoy it. The last couple little things that we have before you here, the food and caffeinated bits here, is sour coffee. Wonder how it happened. Apparently, I under-roasted my coffee yet again, and unfortunately, it came out a little bit sour, so my Sumatran is a little... And that's no fun for anybody. We're still working on the reviews and everything to go up there. And the last little story that we have for you here is from over at needcoffee.com, where the fine folks over there have actually done a little taste test on sugar versus high fructose corn syrup. They've done a triangle test, and I'm not going to ruin the punchline for you, but they tested Pepsi versus Pepsi Throwback and Coke versus Mexican Coke. The only thing that I will tell you is that if you naturally favor Coke, no matter where you, if you naturally favor one product, and that's all you've ever known, you're always going to kind of gravitate towards that as the like versus the other. That's all I'm going to say. So, moving beyond that, thank you so much for listening to this extended babbling edition here at the Caffeination Podcast. Hopefully we've kind of worked on some interesting little problems that you'll be able to go back or add in comments. I'm always thrilled to see people comment in on the stuff that we talk about. And just remember, if you'd like to sign up for the Friends of Caffeination, you can click the Google Friend Connect icon. You can sign up through OpenID, Google, AIM, or Yahoo. It's all listed over in the top middle column on the Caffeination website at www.caffeination.com. That allows you to comment without having to sign in or any fun little captchas. You just have to be signed into whatever account that it was. You don't have to create an account on my site. How fun is that? All right. If you have any comments, feedback, suggestion, or hate mail for me on this episode or any of the other stuff that we talk about, please feel free to fire one off to caffeination@gmail.com or contact me on Twitter at caffeination, caffeination.com. This has been a fantastic, long, and kind of interesting episode. Hopefully you have enjoyed it thus far. You can head back and play it again if you'd like to hear me stutter. So, all right, thank you so much for listening, and stay caffeinated, people.